The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt podcast, bringing to you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Here's another piece I'll trust you enjoy.
And I'm joined from the top and for the entire hour by Dan Senor. Dan is the host of the extraordinary Call Me Back podcast, which you can listen to two or three times a week. He's the author with Saul Singer of two books that are important to you. The Genius of Israel came out recently, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World, and the other book, Startup Nation. First of all, Dan, thanks for your books. Thanks for the introduction to Aviv Redinger. Thank you for Call Me Back, and thank you especially, well, for all of that, but also Daniel Gordis and his Israel, the Story of a Nation Reborn, History of Zionism. I've read three times since you recommended it to me, listened to it twice and read it once, because it's such an extraordinary summary of so much I didn't know, because I only know really the Jewish story post-1945 and the American Jewish story post-1974 when I start to meet Jewish people at school. So, Dan, you've been doing yeoman's work, but I wanted to spend an hour with you, especially after listening to your Call Me Back podcast with Haviv. Your title was My Come to Jesus Moment with Haviv Redinger, in which Haviv says, if Sinwar can say we are still standing, he will say that Israel cannot even destroy Hamas, the weakest of Israel's enemies. The ramifications, Israeli deterrence, are catastrophic. Matter of time before Israelis leave and sail away like the Crusaders. That's what Hamas would say. So, Dan, the bottom line, the first question, we'll come back around. Is President Biden, has Secretary Schumer thrown Israel under the bus?
I don't think from a pure policy standpoint, Hugh, and as you know, in our last episode, the one you're citing with Haviv Redinger, Haviv and I, who are very close personally and usually see events similarly. We typically, you know, share the same analysis. The first time we got into kind of a little bit of a heated, respectful but heated disagreement, because we both have been of the view that what President Biden has done for Israel post October 7th was extremely important and supportive. And I think it's important just to rattle off a few of those things, right? One, he made a very powerful statement right after October 7th in support of Israel. He made it clear which side he was on a number of ways, not the least of which is he flew to Israel, sat with the war cabinet, you know, most powerful leader in the world, the man who leads the commander in chief of the most powerful military in the world, goes to Israel, deploys military assets to the Eastern Mediterranean, sending a signal to Hezbollah, gets munitions going to Israel on a pretty steady clip. Which was impressive because of the dysfunction in Congress and the White House worked around it. And he gave Israel diplomatic cover at the UN, vetoing bad UN resolutions. He deserves credit for all those things. Haviv and I, in our podcast every week, had been basically saying that. Where I took issue with Haviv is he believed that if Biden at some point has to ding Israel rhetorically, not substantively, but ding them rhetorically to pander to his base, as Haviv would say, if he's got to do some things to win Michigan at Israel's expense, we can handle it. And I was willing to not protest Haviv's take. I was sort of along for the ride. I saw what President Biden did at the State of the Union address and the criticisms unprecedented for him or for any president for that matter. The criticisms he made against Israel were to me, over the top, to use his phrase, and unfair and very damaging. And then a couple of interviews that Vice President Harris did over the subsequent days, and even an interview the president did. And my argument to Haviv was, it is true that at a substantive level, the president has been doing the right thing on the policy front. But rhetoric has consequences. And when you unleash the kind of criticisms against Israel that Biden was doing, it provides jet fuel, rocket fuel, for Israel's critics, for Israel's opponents, to include the UN, to include many capitals throughout Europe, to include many countries in the broader Arab Muslim world, to include the media. And not that those they were holding back, but Biden validated their criticisms. And so if there is a pylon on Israel, President Biden added to it, contributed to it. He provided rocket fuel for it with the things he said. And I'm happy to go through the things he said in our podcast episode. We literally chronicle the, some of the most damaging.
We're going to do that, too. I've got the
President
tape.
Biden said,
I brought the receipts because I want you to be able to respond.
And I thought it was outrageous.
It is outrageous. And then Chuck Schumer yesterday, we'll come to this. The hubristic moment of the millennium is when Chuck Schumer stands up in the well of the Senate and tells Bibi Netanyahu that he's the problem. I actually don't have a precedent for this in American history. I don't think we've ever, maybe the appeal to King George that was filed before the Declaration of Independence, but it just, the idea that our majority leader in the Senate would lecture a democratically elected leader of our ally who's been invaded, savaged, pilloried, and has hostages is astonishing. And the fact that the president didn't mention anti-Semitism in America and stated all of that. But I want to get to my bottom line and test it on you. This is a political calculation that they do have weakness on their left. I think you and Haviv and I agree on that. But I believe it's gone so far now that he is going to suffer loss of his Jewish American voters and his Friends of Allies voters. And I want people to know the numbers. In 2000, Al Gore got 79% of the Jewish American vote. In 2004, John Kerry got 76%. In 2008, President Obama got 78%. In 2012, that dropped to 69% for President Obama. It went back up for Hillary Clinton to 71% in 2016. And in 2020, Joe Biden only got 68% of the American Jewish vote in the general election. I think he is putting a lot of that 68% at risk, Dan. I really do, because American Jews are afraid right now. They actually feel fear. I'm 68. I'm older than you. All of my Harvard buddies who are Jewish that I lived with for 4 years, we've talked about this. They can't believe what they see at our alma mater. And I believe this will have, unless he changes course in a hurry and gets back to saying, we stand with Israel. We will supply Israel. Hamas must be destroyed. He's going to hemorrhage Jewish American votes and Friends of Israel votes. What do you think?
So, I agree, and I know it because I'm already hearing it. And I, as you said, you're hearing it from your buddies from Harvard. I am hearing it from friends of mine. I live in New York City. Let's just say I have a lot of very liberal Jewish friends in New York. And what more and more of them are saying to me now, and by the way, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Biden's going to lose New York in 2024, but it's representative of where the Jewish community is nationally. What I friends tell me is, well, maybe I'll just sit it out. Maybe I just won't vote, which is in and of itself extraordinary. And then they're even open to voting for Trump, which I just never thought I would see in a million years. Look, to me, the state to watch, which is the most interesting, is Pennsylvania.
Yes, Philly suburbs.
Pennsylvania is interesting. Right, Philly suburbs. So you can't win. Biden can't win Pennsylvania without the Philly suburbs, and you can't win the Philly suburbs if you don't, if you have not consolidated the Jewish vote, because the Philly suburbs are largely populated by Jewish.
Home
Jewish
to many American there. Jews. Home as is Pittsburgh, not as big as right. Philly, but Pittsburgh.
Right. So you can't win Pennsylvania without the suburbs, and you cannot win. Biden can't win the presidency without Pennsylvania. If he loses Pennsylvania, he's going to lose. So let's look at other Democratic leaders in Pennsylvania and what they've been doing. And the ones I point to are John Fetterman and Josh Shapiro. Now, regardless of what one may think of those two, the governor of Pennsylvania and the junior senator of Pennsylvania, on other issues, they are both trying to chart a course that is independent from the progressive base of the party. Of the Democratic Party, specifically John Fetterman, what issues is he most vocal on these days? He's most vocal on being, quote unquote, tough on crime. He's very critical of the administration's policies that have thus far that have gotten this migrant crisis going at the rate it's going. And what else has John Fetterman done?
He is pro-Israel.
Been an outspoken pro-Israel, and not only pro-Israel, Hugh, but makes a point of sticking it to the progressive left.
Josh Shapiro is the governor of Pennsylvania. He's a friend of mine. I think he is the most talented Democrat in America. And if I were a Republican, I would be afraid that he would be somehow ending up on a ticket with Gavin Newsom or somebody else as the vice president to lock down Pennsylvania. He's a very impressive guy. I have not followed what he said about this hostage crisis and this war. What has he said?
Well, where he has made his marks on certain issues in Pennsylvania, I'm not with him on everything, but he's been more moderate than more most of the party is. But
yes,
where he's been incredibly, I think, important is speaking out against anti-Semitism on American college campuses. Because
yes,
you remember one of the first battlegrounds was the University of Pennsylvania. And Liz McGill, who was the president of Pennsylvania, of Penn, who was on that congressional, that House panel with the president of Harvard and the president of MIT. And Shapiro has been speaking out about anti-Semitism is a real issue, which I believe also our president should be doing. And so my only point to you is that I think those two guys are examples of a way Democrats could and should govern and lead on issues that matter. And the reason I say this, think this is important, is because President Biden being so critical of Israel right now has, as I said, it validates the pile-on against Israel. But I also think it's a proxy for a sense of disorder right now in America, right? These protesters against Israel, right? They're blocking bridges, they're blocking highways to airports, they're protesting in front of hospitals, they are causing chaos. And I don't care, you may not be, a majority of Americans are pro-Israel, but it's not even about that. You don't have to be engaged in Israel to find this disruption in daily American life to be outrageous. And I think President Biden, you asked me, do I think President Biden runs the risk of losing a state like Pennsylvania because of this, if he panders too much to the left on Israel? Yes, I do. But not just because of Jewish voters. I also think there are other voters who aren't Jewish who, like I said, may be sympathetic to Israel, but that's not a top three issue for them. But they watch what's happening. And they say, who are these anti-Israel protesters, and why are they causing such disorder in our country? And we are against what they are doing. We
are, Dan. I want to stress. I listen to Call Me Back Pod, and I listen to all of my Jewish American friends and all of the Israeli media sources. But I think there are a considerable number of voters in America who are in the middle or on the center right, like I am, or on the center left, as some of my friends in the Democratic Party are, for whom the allyship with Israel matters quite a deal. I don't think we should underestimate how many people are not Jewish for whom this is the number one issue. Do you want to put a percentage on that of the electorate? I'm going to guess it's at least 5% of the electorate.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one here that blew me away. I was with a number of Senate Republicans, Republican senators, 2 days ago in Washington, talking to them about Israel and what's happening in Israel and the Middle East. And I made this point. I made the point I'm making to you right now, that this is an issue that matters not just to American Jews. And one of the senators, I won't say his name, said to me after, he said, you know, it's funny that you say that. We polled, our campaign polled 20 or 30 issues against our opponent, Democratic opponent, to get a sense of which issues, which criticisms of our opponent resonated the most. And he said, we want to find the top three issues. And he said concerns about the rise in anti-Semitism was among the top three.
Two nights ago, George W. Bush was at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, and the president was off the record, but I can count. I think I can say this without giving away any confidences. Israel is the most dangerous nation in the world today, according to W. And I believe Americans know that, and I believe they know that we've got Americans held hostage, and the president doesn't name them, and he doesn't name the Abbey Gate victims, he doesn't name the three Jordanian soldiers who were killed over there. We're not stupid. We all see the world, and Iran is moving chess pieces around, and we don't know what's going on. We're actually dumbfounded by this.
Yeah, I think President Bush. It sounds like I agree with him. This point about hostages is interesting to me. So Bill McGurn with the Wall Street Journal, the columnist for the Wall Street Journal, wrote a very good column on the Monday before President Biden's, or maybe it was the Tuesday before President Biden's State of the Union address, in which he said, why don't Americans know the names of the Americans, of their fellow citizens who are being held in tunnels under Gaza hostage? Why aren't they household names? And he was right. I hadn't really thought about it. I spoke to Bill when he was working on that piece. I connected him actually to a couple of hostage families, American families who have children being held in Gaza. Tragically, one of them was just the parents just found out that he was dead. Itai Chen, who was a he was in a tank in southern Gaza. He was pulled out of the tank, taken hostage, and they now know he was killed. They're originally from Long Island. And they, when Brittany Griner was taken, you know, by Putin, every American knew who Brittany Griner's name, President Biden, the
ASAP Rocky, when he was ASAP Rocky was right. held in Sweden, right. and Ambassador O'Brien was then the SPIHA, Special Presidential Envoy in Hostage Affairs, a good friend of mine, and we found out about ASAP Rocky all the time. We knew the name of every hostage, and we haven't heard one name. There has been a Fox News story on each of the five that are thought to be alive, but it's not. It's neither mm-hmm. across the president's lips.
Right. And so, and by the way, what happened at the State of the Union is the families of the American hostages were there in the chamber, but they were invited there not by the president. They were invited there by members of Congress. Lindsey Graham brought the Chen family, the parents, a couple of, it was bipartisan, some Republicans, some Democrats brought these Americans, and that forced the president's hand. I'm not sure President Biden would have, at least he didn't mention their names. At least he mentioned that there were Americans being held. I'm not sure he would have had the parents not been in the chamber. And the only reasons the parents were in the chamber was because members of Congress brought them there.
Let me play for you a cut from that State of the Union. Cut 17, please, for Dan Senor, host of Call Me Back Pod.
And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza and ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. They're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. For the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration.
Stop.
Or a bargaining chip.
Dan Senor, that is an insult. Israel has never used humanitarian aid as leverage. And I can't believe that line got into the speech. And Haviv mentioned to you, maybe he just has bad speechwriters. I've done a lot of bad speechwriters. What you should have said is a presidential speech goes through about 50 pairs of hands. Everybody sees what's in it. Not a mistake.
I said to Haviv, I've been involved with this process. The number of eyes on a presidential speech is just staff, cabinet secretaries that work on the issues that are addressed in the speech draft. I mean, it's just endless the number of people see it. There's no errors are extremely rare in a State of the Union address. Or at least factual errors. That was a glaring factual error.
It was an attack.
Not only glaring.
It was an attack on Israel.
But here's the thing. If you want to say Israel's record of delivering humanitarian aid to the Palestinians is uneven, that's fine. Because it's hard. It's complicated. But it's not a decision Israel's making. It's not a strategic decision Israel's making to like some kind of collective punishment of civilians.
I'm surprised they didn't use the term Shylock and use some other trope from the Protocols of the Elder of Zion. It was really an anti-Israel moment. Dan, you know the old adage, that which gets rewarded gets repeated. Today, as we talk, Hamas has offered to release some Israeli hostages in exchange for 1,000 prisoners, including many terrorists who are serving life sentences. And there's a demand for the complete Israeli withdrawal mixed in there. I think they are acting rationally as evil people, realizing that Joe Biden has got round heels. What do you think? I think Hamas is just reacting to the fact they're cornered. They're dead unless they get the West to make Israel back off.
Yeah, they've got. I mean, Defense Minister Gallant, who I know, who's a quite extraordinary and impressive figure. Early in the war, had the theory inside the War Council in Israel that the best way to get the hostages back, everyone wants the hostages back, the best way to get the hostages back is to pound Hamas militarily, hit them hard. If they feel like they are under siege and that Israel is not going to be tentative in its response, the only defense they have is trying to get Israel to pull back by releasing hostages. And so, by November, they had the first hostage deal. So I think his strategy has borne out. And I think the only reason, I think this last month has been frustrating, because I think Sinwar and the Hamas leadership have been playing the West by dragging things out with these negotiations that haven't gone anywhere, because they were concerned that Israel's about to go into Rafah, which I think they are. And that's where the remaining four battalions of Hamas are based. And it is where Sinwar and the leadership of Hamas are based. They do not want Israel coming into Rafah. So they've been dragging out these hostage negotiations in the hope that they could head off an Israel advance into Rafah. I think they also wanted to avoid it happening during Ramadan, be that as it may. I think up until now, the only progress Israel has been able to achieve has been when they've been putting military pressure on Israel, not when the U.S. and international institutions have been telling Israel to cool off.
Pressure on Hamas? That's when it works, is Hamas people.
Yeah, that's my point. When Israel is putting military pressure on Hamas and advancing, and when Hamas believes, oh my gosh, they're coming, they're moving forward, they went to Khan Yunis, you know, they went to the north, then they went to Khan Yunis, and now they're going into Rafah, they're not stopping. When Hamas believes that is the trajectory and the momentum, that is when they want to negotiate. When President Biden and others are criticizing Israel and telling Israel to hold back, and telling Israel to rethink its advance into Rafah, that's when they're not so interested in negotiating.
I'm going to ask you this on the other side as well, but I fear we're coming up on a Munich moment. And by that, I mean a moment at which Joe Biden surrenders to Sinwar's demands and threatens Israel effectively so that they are allowed to remain in Rafah. Do you fear that happening, Dan Senor? And we've got about 30 seconds till we go back on the radio show across the country.
Yeah, Hugh, I am. I'm really, really concerned. And these next few weeks are key. And I think that I think there's a good chance that Israel is going to advance during Ramadan.
I think they should. Otherwise, you're going to end up with that. Chuck Schumer was a flare. That was not an uncoordinated speech. Do you agree with me? The White House knew what Schumer was going to do.
I believe the White House asked Schumer to do.
Right. Okay, we do agree.
I don't think Chuck Schumer came up with this on his own. I think it was completely coordinated and requested by the administration. We can talk a lot about that. I have a lot of thoughts on what Schumer did. I thought what Schumer did was really damaging.
Yeah.
Fortunately, he's now backtracking.
Well, he'd better, or he's going to lose New York. I mean, there's one way for Chuck Schumer to lose New York, and it's to lose his Jewish supporters, and there are a lot of them. And I'm so stunned by that speech.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if he crosses and they continue, cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going out. There's other ways to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas. And it's like the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a war captain. I said, look, don't make the mistake America made. America made a mistake. We went after bin Laden until we got him. But we shouldn't have gone into Ukraine. I mean, we shouldn't have gone into the whole thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't necessary.
Dan, we have never imposed a red line on an ally, much less an ally that is fighting a war of survival, not an existential war anymore, but the existential war is coming with Hezbollah. What do you make of this, and why would Chuck Schumer agree to do what he did as their cat's paw?
There's so much to unpack there. First of all, I don't even know what he was talking about, a red line. Like, he didn't even talk about what exactly the red line is, going into Rafah or going into Rafah in a way that the administration doesn't want Israel to go into Rafah. What is it? What is the consequence of the red line? I mean, it was so garbled. I honestly don't even know what he was talking about. A. B. Soon before Israel launched its ground invasion, senior military officers from the U.S. were asked by the administration to go brief the Israeli War Council and warn them, based on the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, how difficult counterinsurgency fighting is, and let them know you're going to have a lot of casualties. Is it really worth it? A version of what he was saying right there. And from what I understand, the estimates that were provided to Israel would have resulted in 10 times the casualties that Israel has experienced in Gaza so far. Now, it's not to say that the casualties in Gaza are awful. Every one of those lives are heroes, and it's a tragedy. But I got to tell you, Hugh, the numbers are a lot lower, and obviously these things can change, so I don't want to sound too overconfident or cavalier about this, but the numbers are a lot lower than the U.S. had forecast. Like I said, 10% of what the U.S. said the casualties will be. So I don't even know so he's wrong about comparing the Israeli experience to the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we can have a whole separate debate about whether he was right about Iraq or at least about Afghanistan. As for Chuck Schumer, look, I thought what Schumer said was I'm perplexed by it. I rarely hear Chuck Schumer weigh in on a foreign policy matter. I rarely hear him call. I don't think I've ever heard him, and I'm happy to be corrected. I've never heard him call for a change of government in any country.
I agree. I don't think so.
Or Democrat.
I don't think so.
And here's the most, even if he were, he has such a problem with the policy and not Netanyahu, because keep in mind, Netanyahu is a divisive figure in Israeli politics. Netanyahu is an unpopular leader today in Israeli politics, but his policies aren't. His policy in Gaza, his policy in taking on Hamas, is the policy of the war cabinet. The war cabinet includes not only the prime minister, but it includes his chief political opponent, Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz right now is polling way higher than Netanyahu. If an election were held today, Benny Gantz would be able to form a very strong majority coalition government. The combination of Netanyahu's seats and where Gantz is polling represents the overwhelming majority of the country, of Israel, from right to left. There is a right-left consensus on what needs to be done in Gaza, and they are that consensus is represented by the support of Netanyahu and Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot and others. And so what's Schumer complaining about? Schumer says Netanyahu's the problem. It sounds like they have a problem with the policy, not with Netanyahu, but they don't want to say that. So
they are engaged in campaign 2024. The purpose of this hour is for me to test my theory on you that this is all about campaign 2024. They are worried about a few percentages of votes in 7 swing states, but they have no idea. We can also, 2 things can be true. They're worried about losing 2024, and the campaign is run by stupid people. Because we sometimes think that campaign people are wizards, and sometimes they turn out not to be wizards. They turn out to be, my friend Stuart Stevens botched the 2000 and 2012 campaign, just botched it completely. And you go back to Bob Beckel in 1984, and he made jokes about it. People can botch a campaign. They're botching this campaign, Dan. And I want to ask you, do you think the American Jewish community and its friends, like Irish Catholic Zionists like me, which is a funny way to say it, but it's true, should we all go back to the mall to remind them that 300,000 people can show up on 3 days' notice?
Yeah. Look, I don't quite understand the campaign strategy, the Biden campaign strategy, because they are so, I think, overly concerned about this progressive base, this pandering base, this uncommitted vote that showed, quote unquote, showed up in Michigan for the primary, which I think they're overreacting to, because A, as a percentage of the Democratic vote that turned out in Michigan, it was about the same as the non-committed, quote unquote, non-committed vote that showed up for President Obama. So it wasn't way off.
It was worse in Minnesota and Washington State. It was 20% in Minnesota and 20% in Washington State did not vote for Biden.
But either way, Hugh, these are votes. These are protest votes without consequence.
Agree.
So it's easy if someone wants to register a statement and say, all right, I'm going to make a statement. I want to send a message that I don't like President Biden's policy on Israel and Hamas. So I'm going to vote non-committal. Non-committed. Fine. Go ahead. Do it. Like sei gesund, as we say in Yiddish. Like have at it. All right. But in November, they're not going to do that. Do you know why? Because they think, well, if I do it then, I get Donald Trump as president.
Yeah.
In other words, a protest vote in November has consequences.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. If you enjoy your podcast, take a moment, tell a friend to subscribe today. Send them to our website, townhallreview.com. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.